This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, President Bush made a stop in Madison County, Illinois, to speak about tort reform. Standing in front of 150 doctors in white medical coats, the president said frivolous litigation pushes the total cost of our tort system to billions of dollars each year. This was one of several stops the president made last week in a campaign to win congressional and public support for change. It's a debate that we've addressed on this program in the past and will address again as the issue moves ahead. But today, we hope to talk about the underlying issue of motive. Why do so many people decide to file suits in the first place? And why do so many more decide not to? We're not talking about divorce or domestic disputes, but torts, claims for damage. Do people sue because they're angry, as an aspect of political activism, or just to get some answers? Later in the program, India's ambassador to the U.S. joins us to talk about why his country declined to accept international aid after the tsunami. But first, what fuels the urge to haul somebody into court? You're invited to join the conversation, of course. If you've ever sued somebody, or if you thought about it and changed your mind, call and tell us why. What were your motives? Did you regret your decision later? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And here with us in Studio 3A is Eva Rodriguez, editor-in-chief of Legal Times. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
So why do you think that people decide to sue?
I think we have to start with the premise of there are some charlatans out there. Okay, there are folks out there who will take any opportunity without being harmed to try to make some money. Mm-hmm. And I think both sides of this debate, as contentious as it is, can agree on that. There are some bad apples out there. So if we're assuming that we're talking about reasonable, legitimate people, I think that the record shows more often than not that most people do sue because they're angry. They're angry that they've been hurt in some way. They're angry that they've been treated unfairly. They're angry that they bought that lemon of a car. So they need to find somebody to take that rage out on and somebody to, sometimes literally, make them pay.
Mm-hmm. Make them pay.
And
is it personal or is it, well, let's make sure this never happens again?
I think that depends on the individual and the circumstances. I mean, I do think that sometimes people rush to court over something that essentially is a personal dispute. You're parking in my parking space, my neighbor, mm-hmm. and I'm angry, and I have no other way of making you see how reasonable I am, and hence I'm going to drag you into court. But I do think that there are some people out there, after they get over their own initial anger or pain or what have you, that want to make sure that this doesn't happen, whatever this is, to anyone else again.
Now, you're talking largely about individual suits here. There's another mm-hmm. type of lawsuit, the class action suit. Is that different?
I think that it is a little bit different in that I think there may be evidence to show that a lot of times class action lawsuits are lawyer-driven. Sometimes they're lawyer-triggered. If you see, for example, Vioxx was mm-hmm. recently taken off the market by Merck, and all of a sudden, just out of the blue, you think, you see advertisements by lawyers saying, if you think you or a loved one has been harmed by Vioxx, call 1-800-ME, or whatever the number may be, trying to look for as many people as possible to join this class action, if you will, because essentially it gives them more leverage, more negotiating power against the company. It also, if you ask that lawyer filing the suit, it would also say that's just the best, most efficient way to redress harms, to take care of people, a big class of people who've been hurt by one manufacturer. Mm-hmm.
Do significant numbers of people consider suing and change their minds?
You know, I don't have statistics off the top of my head about that to address that globally, but in covering the law for 15 years or so and working for a legal newspaper now, mm-hmm. I can tell you that a lot of people's first or perhaps second reaction is, we've got to sue. You know, somebody's got to, you know, make me right. Somebody's got to pay. And then they open their eyes. They get a little bit more informed. As much as we watch Law and Order or L.A. Law, that is not the way the real world works. Things don't just get worked out at the end of an episode or at the end of a series, at the end of a year.
Or at the end of 5 years.
The end of 5 years. It takes years and years, more often than not, to resolve even the simplest, seemingly simplest kind of lawsuit. And oftentimes it also takes a heck of a lot of money out of the plaintiff, the person who's bringing the suit, out of their own pocket. So many times people decide, you know, it's just not worth it.
And again, there are different ways that lawyers accept payment for lawsuits. Some of them, as you say, are I would think most of them people pay out of their own pocket, but there's some that are done basically on commission.
Right. For most kind of actions that are brought in court, your divorce case, things like that, you pay a lawyer either a lump sum up front to say, hey, take care of this divorce or take care of this will. But in most cases, when you're talking about product liability, you're suing Ford over the exploding gas tanks, for example,
right,
or you're trying to sue Merck for damage brought by Vioxx, many lawyers will take those cases on contingency, which means they, in theory, will not get a nickel unless they win money for you. And in that case, whatever money they win for you, they'll take 30 to 40%.
And you say in theory?
In theory, there are some lawyers who are ethically challenged who may have different arrangements, but that's the way it is supposed to work. Mm-hmm. I don't get paid unless you get paid, my client.
If you've thought about suing, if you went ahead with it, give us a phone call. If you changed your mind, we'd also like to hear from you. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Let's talk with Mike, who joins us on the phone from Painesville, Ohio.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Mike.
How you doing today?
Okay.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I'm also driving, so if I'm distracted, I'm sorry.
Well, drive safely.
I have a medical condition which requires me to take a continuous dosage of a particular type of medication, it's an immunosuppressor.
Mm-hmm.
And I got sick, and my primary care physician prescribed for me a drug which interacted with it, and in fact, it shut it off. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The upshot was I spent 3 days in the hospital recovering from the interaction, and I thought about suing, and I decided against it.
How come?
Well, as I told the lady who answered the phone, I'm not entirely sure. I think it was a combination of factors. I didn't want to add to the the count of lawsuits going on out there. I also just kind of thought about it for a while, and I thought, you know, maybe this was just an honest mistake, and it's really not worth dragging her into court for. So that's kind of where I was at.
Eva, I would think that's not uncommon.
I don't think it is uncommon, honestly. I mean, it seems like a decent, honorable response, and hopefully, caller, you didn't suffer any permanent injury or anything like that. But those are exactly the kind of cases you don't hear about. You don't. There's no way to really document that.
Mike, have you regretted your decision?
No, not really. I've gone back to the same doctor, and she's treated me well, so I'm kind of happy with my decision.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And continue driving safely. Let's take a look now at individual suits. A lot of these are brought forward by personal injury lawyers. One such, the famous Johnny Cochran, here is a TV ad of his describing the importance of looking out for the little guy.
We think it's a great opportunity to represent the little guy. Very often in society, nobody wants to pay any attention to the little guy. Don't give him a fair shot. We feel that once we listen to the facts, once we prepare the case, we believe preparation is a key. We can turn the little guy into someone who represents all of us. That little guy becomes the representation of all the rest of us. And he gets a fair shake in society. I think that's important for everybody else.
Joining us now is Ken Suggs, president-elect of the Association of Trial Lawyers of America and a practicing personal injury lawyer in South Carolina. He's with us by phone from his office in South Carolina. Nice of you to be with us today.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Do you agree with Johnny Cochran? People don't pay enough attention to the little guy?
Well, I actually do agree with Johnny Cochran about that the average person is not in a position to evaluate whether medical error has occurred. And if they can't evaluate that, they're not in much of a position by themselves to do anything about it because these cases are fought hard and they're tremendously expensive.
And that's why personal injury lawyers who accept these work on these contingency bases can represent that little guy.
Oh, that's exactly right. In fact, this may not be the subject of the program, but in my office, I give every client the opportunity to pay me the way the doctors and the insurance companies pay their lawyers, and that is by the hour. Win or lose, and I have yet to have anybody take me up on that offer.
Really?
That's correct.
Personal injury lawyers, I'm sure you've probably heard this before, but have been accused of filing a lot of frivolous lawsuits.
Well, I could tell you this. There are few frivolous lawsuits in the medical malpractice arena, and that is because the lawyers who defend these cases for doctors are very good lawyers. They're usually the best defense lawyers in the state. Secondly, the cases are fantastically expensive. You might spend $50,000 to $250,000 in expert witness fees and cost for the case. With that kind of a cost and not getting paid unless you win, you don't take these cases if there's not a strong case.
In your experience, when people come into your office and say, I want to sue, why do they want to do it?
Well, you know, I think of myself as a filter against frivolous lawsuits. I have a lot of people come to my office or call me on the phone, and I spend a good portion of my day every day telling folks, you know, you can't sue because the doctor made a mistake and you might have died. You can't sue because you could never get information from the doctor. You can't sue because you had to wait so long in the waiting room. You know, but what I find for the most part is people come in and they want to know what happened to their loved one. They want to know why this occurred.
Do you explain to people, I'm sure you do, that when they come into your office, this is a long process, it can be a very wrenching process?
It's a terrible process. I mean, the worst of all is someone who has lost a child. And I sit down, and I'm sure my colleagues do this as well, and counsel with those folks that, you know, unless you're committed to following through with this process, it may be something you want to go home and think about or pray about, you know, as your particular desire for guidance goes, before you decide to get involved in the litigation process, which is tough.
Mm-hmm. Ken Suggs, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Ken Suggs is president-elect of the Association of Trial Lawyers of America, a practicing personal injury lawyer in South Carolina, and joined us by phone from his office. We'd also like to thank Eva Rodriguez. She's going to stay with us for the remainder of the program. We want to welcome your calls as well on this issue. If you filed suit, why? If you thought about it and changed your mind, why? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to duck away for a short break. We'll be back right after that. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what drives people to file a lawsuit or what changes people's minds when they decide against it. If you've ever sued anybody before, call and tell us why. Any regrets? The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is Eva Rodriguez, editor-in-chief of Legal Time. And let's take a call. This is Pat. Pat's with us from Cleveland.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
We have are in the process of lawsuit in here in Cleveland, and it does take a tremendous toll on the family. Our family suing on behalf of my grandmother who passed away, and my mother has a number of siblings, and the tension now 2 years into it among the siblings is amazingly high. People start to get cold feet when big dollar figures are at risk.
And so the splits in the family cause more and more tension.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. You know, even folks that were pretty zealous about filing a lawsuit early on have become very, very nervous because, you know, middle-class America and you're looking at folks who are getting ready to retire and looking at perhaps having to pay out of pocket some large amounts of money.
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned 2 years in. Any idea of how long this is all going to take before it's all over?
The lawyer we have is very, very good and did tell the family early on that it may be a lengthy process and not to think in terms of months but in terms of years. And I think your earlier guess is right. It wouldn't surprise me if it did go 3, 4, maybe even 5 years.
Mm-hmm. So in there for the long haul.
I would hope.
Pat, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Eva, that's, you know, obviously the family's involved. You're going to have a lot of problems in your family.
Yeah. And
or you could.
And you could. And things, you could have a lot of problems in your family even if the lawsuit is going well. I mean, if you have a very strong case and you find a company offering $1 million settlement and you've got to split it between Uncle Joe and Aunt Mary and Cousin Sue, they might have different perspectives. So even when things go well, you're going to have a lot of tension. You're going to have a lot of fights.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk now more specifically about lawsuits in the medical field. Why do people decide to sue their doctors? Joining us now to talk about this issue is Dr. Gerald Hickson. He's director of the Center for Patient and Professional Advocacy at Vanderbilt University's Medical Center and associate dean for clinical affairs. He's with us from the studios there at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Good of you to be with us today.
Neil, I'm honored to be with you.
Before we begin, I mean, how many people usually do file suit? I mean, is this a large number?
Well, Neil, there really are not lots of suits in a relative sense, because if you go to the research data, as opposed to just simply relying upon anecdote, we know from the New York State studies and others that there are certain measurable numbers of events that occur. We've seen the information that has help to bring to light the fact that mistakes do occur in medicine, and that we know that nationally there are a fair number of individuals that are clearly injured by medical care. But if you look at those individuals who, by research data, are identified as having suffered an error from an adverse outcome from negligence, we find that only about 2% of those individuals will actually choose to file suit. Now, that's not to say that there are not lots of suits.
Mm-hmm.
For every single individual who files a claim who has, at least according to researchers, a valid claim, there are 5 to 7 times as many individuals that file claims that I would rather say are non-valid. They're never frivolous. And as the point that Pat made just a minute ago, all of these claims take a tremendous toll on the family, the medical profession, society in general. So I would say, opposing a little bit what Ken said earlier, there are lots of suits that are non-valid, but they're never frivolous.
Now, you did a study and talked to patients about why they decided to sue. What did you find?
Well, Neil, we were interested in just simply talking to families that had filed suit and asking them what led them to an attorney in the first place, and we recorded their responses and found that those responses could be sorted into a number of definable sort of categories. We found that a fair number of individuals went to file a suit when they felt that someone that they trusted, whose judgment they valued, suggested that care had been substandard. I think it's important to recognize then in 70-80% of those cases, those influential individuals are actually members of the medical profession. We find that, and it's not surprising, that about 1 in 5 of the individuals that we talked to said that they filed suit because they needed money. And in a society where we don't have often very good ways to provide long-term care for families, it's not surprising that some families are going to need to turn to deep pockets. And in fact, some of the successes we've seen are where states move to create neurologic compensation programs to take care of long-term needs of children. And then I want to reiterate both what Mike said and Pat said and Eva have said. We found lots of evidence in our interviews that many families feel that medical professionals are covering things up, that there's information that's not forthcoming. And 1 out of 5 told our research group that the only reason they ever file suit is that no one would ever tell them what happened. Now, that doesn't mean that no one in the medical profession tried, but remember that all of this is related to the family's perceptions, and that's their reality.
No one told them what happened. They're trying to find out the truth.
Many families told our research team that the only reason I ever took Dr. Hickson to the courthouse is that I never felt I could get clear answers to my questions. And you can imagine that in a circumstance like that, that will generate some degree of anger, because anger is still a real part of this process as well.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email we got from June in Michigan. I believe people have a moral obligation to sue if they're injured by medical malpractice. I have a master's degree in nursing and over 30 years of full-time nursing experience, which has left me with no doubt that suing is the only real control we have over the quality of care that we receive. Most lawsuits, she writes, are not frivolous. Medicine is a dangerous business.
Neil, I would suggest that there are certainly circumstances that occur where bad things have happened and institutions may not be forthcoming in trying to do the right thing. But I would go back to the Harvard studies again, studies that had been replicated in Colorado and Utah, and the data suggest that there are just lots of individuals who will file suit who do not have, according to researchers and evaluation, valid claims but they sue anyway. Now, again, I would also suggest that institutions in medicine are increasingly committed to improving safety and quality, and we need to have our feet held to the fire to continue to improve the quality of service that we deliver. But there are lots of things that we're doing to make medicine better.
Okay. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Sherry, who is with us from Conyers, Georgia.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, thank you for having this topic today. I am a medical malpractice victim and am still in the court suing my OBGYN. I was left an incomplete quadriplegic by my OBGYN.
So you had a... Can you describe for us... first of all, Sherry, I'm terribly sorry about your condition. Can you describe for us the thoughts that went through your head, the motives that you wanted to that went behind your lawsuit?
For me, it was, again, also, not only to get answers, but for me to be able to hold the doctor accountable, period. If I had been injured, for example, by a drunk driver, I could at least hold that person criminally responsible. The only recourse I have, and I was a stay-at-home mother,
mm-hmm.
The only recourse I have is our jury system. And, for example, with a 250 cap, that even that would be taken away from me because, as your other callers have explained, not only does it take an extraordinary amount of money to pursue a case, it takes a fortitude and strength from the individual that, frankly, I never even knew I had. Nor would I have suspected, as a common, everyday citizen who had never had anything happen legally before.
Was an apology offered, and would it have made a difference if it had been?
An apology was not offered, and frankly, in hindsight, at the time, maybe I cannot say now that I know the full ramifications of my injury, what I'm going to have to deal with for the rest of my life, the full impact of it's had on my family, and what all I've gone through. Yes, I probably still would have filed in my case. The extenuating circumstances of my needs are going to endure for the rest of my life, all at the hands of one negligent physician.
Sherry, again, there's nothing we can say that's going to improve your condition.
The thing is, also, if I might add, the bottom line for me is I have endured all this to be able to have my day in court. Win, lose, or draw, that's what I seek.
Sherry, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Hickson, I know that Vanderbilt University actually requires medical professions to take a class on how to communicate errors and to apologize. I'm not sure in Sherry's case it would have made a difference, but you're actually teaching this class right now. What do you teach your students about disclosure?
Neil, we think that this is a critical element of medical education at all levels, from students to residents to senior faculty, because even though I think that many, if not most, medical professionals know how to do this, it's good for us to review our techniques from time to time and be reminded of how important it is, because individuals are affected in the practice of medicine and we need to express our humanity. Now, I would suggest to you that what we teach is that we think that in circumstances where there are clear errors and that they're clearly related to bad outcomes, institutions need to be forthcoming. We need to get to families quickly to let them know that we recognize what's happened, that we want to provide the appropriate response to them. And we think that when you do that, you can't take injuries away always, but you can move to reduce the sort of sources of inflammation that can stay with families forever. And so we think that, number one, we want to empower people to understand that you do the right thing. Now, I want to say that we also, Neil, remind people that sometimes it becomes apparent that there's a bad medical outcome. And sometimes it's clear to me at this moment why it's occurred, and sometimes it isn't. And so we also teach our medical professionals that it's important to understand the need to understand the when of disclosure as well as the how. And so we want to train individuals to understand that sometimes they've got to provide preliminary answers to questions, that they need to go out and with all of the appropriate resources of an institution evaluate and try to understand why something has happened, and then to be committed to full disclosure when all of the information is in. And as a medical professional, I will tell you that there are circumstances in which I certainly thought that there was one reason for care outcome in a case I was involved in, and I learned later that my initial assumptions were wrong, and then sometimes I'm right at the first step. But we want to be sure that professionals are trained and feel comfortable and understand our institution commitment toward full disclosure.
Dr. Hixon, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Gerald Hixon is director of the Center for Patient and Professional Advocacy at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, associate dean for clinical affairs. He was with us from the studios there at Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Dr. Albert Wu is an associate professor of health policy and management at Johns Hopkins University. He's been researching which type of apology most likely would avert litigation. In a study financed by Johns Hopkins Malpractice Insurer, Dr. Wu has videotaped actors portraying doctors as they discuss various types of errors and then either offer no apology, a heartfelt apology, or an insincere apology to their patients. For example, here's a doctor offering no apology for responding slowly to a page.
The nurse paged you 3 times. Why didn't you come to check on Timmy when she was so concerned?
When the nurse paged me, I was busy with other patients and could not respond immediately. When we did talk, she described your son's condition to me, but it did not seem serious.
And here's the same doctor adding a little bit more of an apology to the same patient.
I am sorry that I was unable to see Timothy sooner. This may have caused his condition to be less than optimal prior to surgery. I would also like to apologize to you for subjecting you to such a stressful situation.
Well, joining us now is Dr. Albert Wu. He's with us by phone from the Johns Hopkins AIDS Clinic in Maryland. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you very much.
How did people react to those different types of apologies?
Well, not surprisingly, people off the street who we have shown these videos to have no trouble distinguishing one from the other, and they can tell you pretty clearly which one they prefer.
And even that second one, which just listening to it doesn't seem like much of an apology, that has an effect?
You know, I think that patients no longer feel like punching out the physician, as one of the patients expressed to us. They've said at least it sounds like he is trying. I would say that the physician in that vignette resorted to a little bit too much medical ease.
Yeah.
But it seemed like it was better than nothing.
Let me ask you, and I wanted Eva Rodriguez to respond to this as well. I mean, doctors, aren't they afraid by saying, I made a mistake, that you're just admitting responsibility?
Well, you know, I think that there is a fairly widespread fear that saying sorry is just like saying I am guilty.
Yeah.
But it turns out that this does not really appear to be the case. There's been a little bit sort of an unfortunate precedent where defense attorneys and insurance companies, at least in the past, have suggested the same thing and said things like, you know, do not under any circumstances speak to anyone without talking to me first.
Yeah,
and that sort of thing.
Eva, isn't that typical advice?
That's exactly.
You know, it no longer is. Certainly our...
Excuse me, doctor. I don't mean to cut you off. I was trying to get an answer from Eva Rodriguez.
Well, what surprises me about this is, on the one hand, as a human being, I find their training of doctors admirable. You say you're sorry when you've done something wrong. But I don't hear that. What I hear is, if I offended you, Neil, I'm sorry you feel that way. So I'm sorry you feel bad, but I'm not taking back what I said. So there's this little bit of a tightrope walk here. Moreover, I can't imagine a lawyer for a hospital or a lawyer for a doctor telling them to be forthcoming about, gee, I'm sorry about what happened to your child. I severed his spinal cord accidentally. I can't imagine a lawyer giving that advice.
We just have a few seconds left, Dr. Wu, a very few seconds. You're instructed, Johns Hopkins has a full disclosure policy, but are you instructed as to what to say and how to say it?
We have an instructional video. We are asking people to say exactly what she thought we would never do. We are suggesting that if you did something wrong, you should say, I'm sorry that I did this. And if the institution, something in the system went wrong, you should say, I'm sorry that caused this to happen.
Dr. Wu,
believe that's the right thing to do.
Dr. Wu, thank you very much for speaking with us today. And also our thanks to Eva Rodriguez of Legal Times Magazine. This is NPR News.